When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
SIFPOP Podcast is recorded in front of a live internet audience. Live from a bunker in the heart of the Ozarks, a podcast that believes it's not about the replicant, it's about the replican. It's SIFPOP. Welcome to SIFPOP, streaming live on Mixlr every Friday afternoon or available to download later in your podcast feed, unless, of course, you're a patron. Josh?
Yeah. Patron, get those parts. Sorry. You didn't give me my line. I forgot. It's been several weeks since I did it one time.
It's been 2 weeks.
It's remarkable that I remember that.
Patrons get those perks.
107.9 is the buzz. Plays the hits. I don't know.
I'm Aaron Dicer from YourMovieFriend.com. Each week we'll be joined by a pop culture guru to chat about movies, television, whatever else from the pop culture universe is on our minds. And today's guru is Josh from the Nether Regions.
Woo-hoo! That's my name. Don't wear it out.
In the chat, they say Josh is the first to mess that up in 110 episodes.
That cannot be true.
Well, it's only recently become the guru's job, so you are the first, but maybe not in 110 episodes. I'm so glad to have you on again, man. You were on a couple weeks ago, but you were already scheduled for this one. You were a last-second fill-in for that one. This one, we have had you on the schedule for because you are such a fan of the original Blade Runner.
Yes.
A movie that I just cannot get into. So before we even get into this podcast, give us the stump speech as a Blade Runner apologist for how this movie isn't boring and pretentious.
First of all, I don't know that what I have to say means it's not pretentious.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
When I watched this movie, when I was a kid, you know, I wanted it. I was like, it's a movie about a guy who hunts robots. I'm in, right?
Right. Sure.
And as a kid, I remember thinking like, where's all the things I like in movies? And this movie launched a lot of, you know, B movie versions, that were exactly that and gave, you know, every 13-year-old boy exactly what they wanted that they missed in Blade Runner. Even then, I still was compelled by it, and I think anybody nobody can argue that it's gorgeous.
Right. Absolutely. It is spectacularly gorgeous.
The world is perfection, and so I think that's what draws you in. Here's what I think about it. It is, the story is a simple story. It's not about the story. This is where it gets really pretentious. It is a piece of visual poetry. And I love that the movie was with that kind of budget, that was that bold, took that kind of step to make something that you like just was about how it made you feel through the whole thing, as opposed to the story was simple enough so that you didn't lose any story. I've heard people say that it's a convoluted story and things like that, and I don't buy into that. I think it's a simple, clean, crisp story, and all of the poetry, for sounding pretentious, I know, is what makes people think that it's convoluted. I understand why people think it's boring, you know. I feel like Terrence Malick movies are kind of the same way, and they actually are boring to me because I'm not a fan of his type of poetry.
Sure,
I guess.
Sure, yeah.
But this one. You know, I was watching the exchange between you and Jer from CinemaSins a little bit last night, and he mentioned like the character. He mentioned character and story, and I get the story thing because there's not much there. It's a guy who goes and hunts robots.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of time in between plot points. Like just
sure it does. That's the poetry.
Okay, and sure. And you call it poetry. That's fine.
Well, the thing is, like, the characterization is not. This is addressing one of the things he said. It's not about what the character necessarily says or does. It's about, like, the composition of the shot, or the pace of the shot, or where the character is in the frame. Those type of it's a
sure.
Yeah, very artisan sort of approach to, you know, because you look at it, most of the people are pretty deadpan through a lot of the movie. There's not a lot of emotion, you know, from the main characters and stuff, but you still know. And, you know, there's, you know, 5 minute scenes of them just flying through a city. And I get that in one regard, on the left hand, could be boring, but on the right hand, I feel like it's also just saying so much. And you got to take into account too, in 1980, when was the movie made?
82, I think. Is when it was released.
It was probably also just that much fun to see that spectacle for 5 minutes at a time on a big screen. You know,
could
we're jaded now, but to live in that world that didn't have IMAX and 3D and whatever, and just see this thing that he's created, like, I want to take in as much of that as I can.
All right.
Even after, you know, multiple viewings of the movie over my life, you know, I find new things and look for new stuff, but it also just, it's about how the movie makes me feel. I think that's a true art thing. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I get it. There's an artistic element to it. You know, I would say the best movies figure out a way to do both. You know, they figure out a way to be visually stunning and artistic and frame and all that kind of color and all that kind of stuff that you talk about, and also tell a story that's compelling from start to finish and doesn't, you know, kind of leave the viewer behind. You may be right that it's an element of just not aging well in some ways, because it's not spectacular for us to see that for, you know, 5 to 10 minutes or whatever. That could be part of it. But and also, I did not see it when that would have been something interesting to me. You know, I saw it for the first time just over a decade ago and came to it late with expectations based on, the sci-fi classic moniker that it has. And I was really let down by it, which is why, you know, I watched it again last night just to kind of give it a second chance. But I felt all the same things. In fact, I kind of came away from it even more convinced that it's just not that great of a movie, or that it just hasn't held up well for the most part, for me at least. But
I gotcha.
But that is the original Blade Runner. We're going to be talking about Blade Runner 2049. Excited to do so. We're also going to chat best ever Ryan Gosling films. We've got a Sift Quest about award season that could be interesting. And of course, we'll do some Buried Treasure. But first, we're going to do some Do We Care? I'm going to read some pop culture headlines, Josh, and you're going to decide if we care enough to talk more about them. How about this one to start us off with? Jackie Chan teases Rush Hour 4 possibility, says we just agreed to a script. Do we care?
Yeah.
I care too. I mean, those movies
okay,
are
good.
You know, they're junk food movies, but yeah. Man, I'm really glad Jackie Chan is kind of putting his face back in the limelight.
Yeah, I agree. I saw the Foreigner trailer on Blade Runner last night, and that looks really sharp too. And a little different for him, you know. It's more of a serious jump in at hard drama, it looks like.
Yeah.
I mean, still with a lot of action, but not like some of the cheesier older stuff that I love so much.
I just saw him in Lego Ninjago, and of course that's a totally different thing because he's doing a voice, although he is in their live action as well. And man, there's just one quote-unquote stunt moment in the live action part of that movie. It's not really a stunt, but they had the outtakes at the end, and I just thought, man, do I miss watching Jackie Chan outtakes at the end of, you know, his movies, of all the stunts that go wrong and that kind of stuff. And I don't know that he's going to be doing much of that because he's, you know, getting so old, but man, it still could be fun.
Yeah, I think he still moves. He moves maybe a little slower than he used to, but he still moves like someone who's 30 years younger than he is.
That's true. We haven't even talked about Chris Tucker, his part in it. You know, I haven't seen him in a ton of things lately. Yeah. I mean, you know, Chris Tucker's, I enjoyed his performance in The Fifth Element. It was kind of the first time I knew about him or who he was. Uh-huh. And, you know, he's definitely got his own kind of brand of, you know, fast talking humor. It's kind of like Eddie Murphy turned up to 11, you know, in some ways.
Yeah. Well, when the franchise, so I like the first two, the third one, I don't remember being a huge fan of.
Yeah.
It felt phoned in, but I saw it the one time and I don't really remember why. But I love that era of Jackie Chan too. Whenever he was doing those and he was doing the Westerns with Owen Wilson, Shanghai Noon and Shanghai Nights. Like I loved that era. Whatever, he was just like, who else wants to do a buddy movie?
I need someone who speaks English a little better than me to pair up with.
Yeah.
Here's the quote, exactly what he said. He said, yesterday we just agreed the script probably at the end of this month will have a second draft, and next year probably we will start, I hope, if Chris Tucker agrees. Kind of putting Chris on the spot there. He says, it's not about the money, it's about the time to make it. We're all like old men now. I told Chris Tucker, before we get old, please let's do Rush Hour 4. So sounds like Jackie really wants to get it done. So see if that works for him. You ready for the next one?
Absolutely.
All right. Tyrese blames clown Dwayne Johnson for breaking up Fast and Furious family. Do we care, Josh?
I don't, but I do want to talk about it.
Well, then you care. If you want to talk about it, then you in some way care. Go ahead. Tell me your thoughts on this.
Well, maybe we just want to talk about it to say that I don't care. No. Actually, you talk. I just don't understand.
Have you seen much about it?
No. I haven't. I stopped watching the franchise a long time ago.
Okay.
I tried, and now I got it mixed. Well, I don't remember the last one I tried to watch, but I didn't make it through, and I got mixed up in all of them. So I don't understand. I don't even understand the universe anymore.
How was it before Fast Five that you got that you quit?
I literally just said I have no idea where I was.
But how many have you seen? You should have an idea of how many Fast and Furious movies you've seen.
I think I got them mixed up. So I think I've seen parts of two different ones that I thought were the same one. So okay. I've seen up to four, or how, what are they on now? Seven or eight?
They just did eight.
I didn't see that. Sounds so. I know there's people who love that franchise, and you know what? My brother loves that franchise, and I will say like they are committed to what they're doing.
They
know what I mean?
Like, the kind of movie they're making.
Yeah, I don't want to come in like, oh, these are a bunch of morons making a crappy movie. It's nothing like that. I just, because I know what has to go into, you know, the ridiculousness of like chase scenes and fighting and action. And so I get like how hard it is. I'm not criticizing that at all. I just, I got to one that had The Rock in it. I think that's the one I fell asleep during it. So which one was that? Five? His first time?
I think so. I think he may have been in four. They all kind of jumbled together for me. I'm actually a defender of the Fast and Furious franchise, especially post Fast Five. I think that's where they really locked in on the kind of movie they were making. And they're superhero movies. They're superhero movies with cars. And you know, you just kind of have to suspend your disbelief in the same way that you would in the Marvel universe or something like that. And then you can kind of have fun with it. But this is fascinating to me because I don't know, there's something really interesting to me about public, you know, call outs like this where somebody tries to stir up a beef or something. Uh-huh. And you always wonder what's publicity and what's real. This one feels real to me, but he's basically saying that The Rock is, tearing the family apart because they offered them a spin-off movie for his character and Jason Statham's character. And they took it. And Tyrese is like, they've offered us spinoff movies before. And we said no, because it's all about the diversity of the family and keeping the family together and that kind of stuff. So,
I wonder if is there something that he brings from the music? Like, is the music industry bolder about those sort of things?
You know what? I think you're right. I think you're Kennedy. Absolutely right. There's something. I mean, you look back. The hip hop world is famous for it. You know, the East Coast, West Coast thing. I mean, you know, people are dying. So, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, it gets real in music. But even now, you look at like Taylor Swift, and you know, her latest song is supposedly a diss song. You know, to Katy Perry. I guess I have no idea. But you're right. It definitely seems like from the music world, that's more common, more acceptable.
Well, and I'll say. And I think it's probably common with directors, but I don't see a lot of actors. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, because I know we all hear the stories, but I think like actors, I mean, directors will call each other out, but I don't feel like it happens nearly as much as it does in the music industry.
Here's what he says. Diversity, love, multi-ethnic, worldwide, multi-generational, United Nations, one race, fast family, until Dwayne showed up. I guess this whole time he had a problem because he wasn't the only one on the movie poster.
I like your inflection. Like, you're creating, all the subtext.
How else are you supposed to read it? Hey, that is a direct diss. Anyhow,
yeah. I just like hearing your voice with Tyrese's words. I think.
Do you want me to continue reading? In his
I didn't mean it. Yeah,
no, I was done. But hey, if you like the performance, I'll keep giving it.
give me one more line.
They offered, but you don't have to agree with a solo hashtag Hobbs movie. He wrote. So there you go.
You also sound a little bit like a preteen girl, like auditioning for her first Disney movie.
that's my acting chops, people. That is why I will never be starring with Josh in any Robert De Niro movies coming out soon. That's
well,
all I got.
Well, I know that you're a good actor because I've seen you act a long time
you're
ago.
Too sweet.
So I know that you can do it. I just think it's fun. I like your dramatic reading of Tyrese's words.
Yeah, I may be putting a little stank on it. That's for sure. all right, let's go to number three. Here it is: Burger King trolls McDonald's at recent It premiere. Do we care?
I would like to hear more.
So this was at the premiere in Germany, and Burger King, at the end of the movie, happened, and then on screen, it came up with the moral is never trust a clown, and then the Burger King logo. And people are losing their minds because it basically turned the movie It into one big Burger King commercial.
Which is remarkable because the Burger King, remember their whole thing was like, how creepy can we make the Burger King guy in the mask?
Right, yeah.
So maybe that's a compliment. Maybe they're saying, hey, McDonald's, we tip our crown to you.
Maybe in the sequel, McDonald's will get some product placement and the character will no longer be a clown. It will be a king, you know, kind of the creepy king dude. Maybe they can do that.
Oh, man, that is... We are in a different world than we used to live, man. It is every possible place and way that people can polarize, they're polarizing.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah, that's funny.
Hey, I saw the Krispy Kreme product placement in the Power Rangers movie. I know it can go pretty far, so you never know what they're going to be able to do.
You'll have to fill me in at some point because I do not know that one. Or is this the time to fill me in?
No, I can fill you in. The new Power Rangers movie is such a forced product placement for Krispy Kreme. I've never seen anything like it. It literally is part of three different plot points. They have to meet at a Krispy Kreme because something is buried underneath there, or it's like, and they use lines like an amazing Krispy Kreme donut or things like that. I mean, it's kind of insane. How much of a commercial
that is funny
for Krispy Kreme Power Rangers is. Well, there you go. There's Do You Care for this week. Let's talk some Blade Runner 2049.
Let's do it.
Every leap of civilization was built off the back of slaves. Replicants are the future, but I can only make so many. I had the lock, and he has the key. I think I found him.
That's not possible. If this gets out, we've bought ourselves a war.
Officer K, played by Ryan Gosling, is a new Blade Runner for the Los Angeles Police Department. He unearths a long-buried secret that has the potential to plunge what's left of society into chaos. His discovery leads him on a quest to find Rick Deckard, played by Harrison Ford, a former Blade Runner who's been missing for 30 years. We like to start out with just a simple and quick review. Did we like it, love it, it was just okay, dislike it, or hated it? What do you got, Josh?
Loved it.
I'm right there with you, man. I'm in the loved it camp as well. I thought this movie was absolutely amazing. Let's just geek out about this movie for like the next half hour. How's that sound?
Right, that sounds amazing.
All right, you tell me what's like at the top of your list of reasons you thought this movie was incredible. What are
they? I thought it was so true to the original, but allowed to be its own thing. Everything that I love about the original was there, plus every possible way that you could update it or make it more better, more relevant. Like any questions that people or like people issues people had with the first one, I feel like are eliminated with this one as well. It gives you everything from the first movie plus everything people wanted from the first movie that they maybe didn't get.
Yeah, I'm just going to talk a little bit about that because I am obviously one of those people who don't like the original Blade Runner. I felt the exact same way. I felt like, okay, here now I'm going into this world. It's visually stunning. You know, obviously more so even just because technology has, you know, grown so much. And it's compelling. Like it's compelling all the way through. I'm never bored. I'm never thinking about, you know, how much time has gone by. Not only is there something to look at all the time, there's also something to think about all the time. I felt like the themes in this one were much deeper, at least much more sketched out than in the first one. So I'm thinking about those. It really blew my mind. At the end, I saw like a information on the movie somewhere, and it said running time 2 hours and 44 minutes, and I was like, what? Like I had no clue. I was really shocked because usually when a movie even gets over 2 hours, I start to feel it a little bit. I did not feel it in this movie at all. I was in it the whole time. So I think it's captivating in a way that the first isn't for a lot of people.
Sure. I buy that. I think with that, the world building that the first one had, stepping that up, using that, like that world was never discredited. It was expounded upon as, you know, normal worlds do after 30 years. It's 30 years later. And plus we see more pieces of the planet. So we go to a couple of different locations, and each having their own environment and their own world, their own personality, but still fitting perfectly into this broad world. I was the same. I did know that it was longer only because at one point I noticed that I hadn't seen Harrison Ford yet. But I wasn't worried about it because it was so compelling. I just was like, oh, yeah, they keep talking about him, but where is he?
You know? Yeah, sure.
And I was, and then I got nervous, like, well, I don't want him to show up for the last scene, you know, but, which was not the case. He was there well before that.
And pulls a Force Awakens with Luke. Just be like, yeah, Luke's in this movie.
What? Yeah, I did not.
For
I was not
5 seconds.
I thought the way they treated all that was, man, it was so good. What's his name? Denis Villeneuve.
Villeneuve.
Villeneuve, is that? Yeah, man. He's clearly a fan of the first. You could tell like all the collaboration and all the tight work that went into making that the same world, but more of it.
And man, is it gorgeous.
Man.
The colors in the framing in this movie, the effects are, you know, they seem flawless to me in this film.
Yeah.
And all of them are informing what's going on in the story and with these characters. And none of it felt, to me, none of it felt pretentious. It didn't feel like we're showing off. We're just, you know, trying to be, you know, more artsy than the movie requires. It was just so beautiful to look at all the way through.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. And, you know, we talked about the visual poetry of the original Blade Runner in my pretentious speaking earlier. I feel like this movie is the same way. He lets the characters do a little more of the work than they did in the first movie, but there's still so much that of the story that's just told by the frame and the shot. And like I said, where the character is standing in the frame, you know, it tells you leagues. It just tells a huge story beyond, like, cause there's not a lot of talking in the movie. I mean, there's a couple of exposition scenes that are still really interesting, but generally speaking, it's, you know, a guy usually by himself
right.
on his journey, you know, not a ton of dialogue.
A Sorkin movie, this is not. It is not, you know, witty repartee and quick dialogue. And I mean, I think there is some interesting and clever dialogue, but you're right. It's delivered very deliberately. And that in the movie just feels very deliberate from the beginning to end. Yeah. It just feels like it's willing to give us the information at the time we need the information in the way that it wants to. And it just all worked for me. Secondary to the visuals, but just barely, is the sound. And I don't know if you got a chance to see it, you know, what kind of sound you got a chance to see it in, but man, I was blown away by this soundtrack. And it's very influenced by that, you know, the original Blade Runner soundtrack, which that's one of the things about the original movie that I think was very innovative and interesting, especially for the time. I don't know, again, that it holds up extremely well. The synth on it, you know, definitely feels dated in the original. But this one pays homage to it in so many ways, but expands it. And the way the sound in this movie creates emotion and energy is so powerful.
Yeah. I feel like in the first movie, like all of these things that were done to expertise at that era, and then we've graduated past a lot of that in what we're capable of now. And I feel like this movie did the same thing. It is maxed out, like what we're capable of in 2017. In 30 years, people may be like, yeah, that was great for the time, you know, but right now it's like, it's the edge. It's the edge of how inventive and how, and the way, like just the, sometimes where it was unclear if the soundtrack or the sound effects were different.
Right. Yeah, like no, absolutely.
Blended together. It's like, wait, is this a part of the soundtrack or is this a part of the scene? Like, it was, pretty meticulous.
Let's talk about performances a little bit because I thought those were spectacular as well. Ryan Gosling continues to impress me to no end. That dude is, he is making a case to be my favorite actor working for sure.
Right on.
I love the simplicity of he's got this cool presence to him, and yet he's not afraid to break out of that box at moments to emphasize the emotion of a scene or what's going on internally with him. You always feel like he's in control, but at the same time, he is revealing himself in a way that feels almost vulnerable. If that makes sense. I'm so impressed with Gosling. I saw him on Saturday Night Live recently when he was on, and I was just like, he even makes like a sketch show where he's just getting sketches 5 days ago and reading them off cue cards. He's making them believable. Nobody goes on SNL and does believable acting. Like, it's just, I'm just like, he's so impressive with the stuff that he does. I really like Gosling.
I agree. I felt like across the board everybody was really great. And I will say too, I really think the movie was built to help that, you know, like I was talking about, like the characters' journeys, where they were in the frame or the composition or in the light or the dark, you know, that all that stuff just gave them every tool they needed to be right, like be super, like very natural, right where they needed to be. They were all present in the moments. I thought Harrison Ford, even, who I've always loved, but I've never thought like an amazing actor.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But I've always loved him. I thought, like, I was like, this guy is like, he's still great. Like, you see why he's still a legend, not just because he was Han Solo and Indiana Jones and Decker, you know, he's got real chops and he knows how to be real in the moment and work with people. Like the scenes of them together, like they're solid scenes.
I thought Harrison Ford was fabulous. I think it's the best I've ever seen him, actually. And I the emotion that this movie pulls from its, you know, material is pretty impressive, and crucial to the message and the themes that it's going with. You know, it's crucial that we buy in to the emotion of what's going on here with these people and their connection to the overall story. And of course, purposely, we're avoiding, you know, any kind of spoilers story wise. We'll talk about those in the spoiler cast. But the ability for us to connect with Harrison Ford's character, to connect with you know, Gosling's character, to connect with all of these people and what they're going through. The other one, and I apologize, I don't have her name up in front of me. I should probably look it up. But she worked closely with Jared Leto's character at...
Oh, yeah. She was great.
Oh, I thought she was amazing. I really did. Yeah. And I am going to look up her name just so we can say it. But I do feel
what
like...
What a complicated character, too. Like, she was playing... Every scene, she was playing several things.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so many layers.
She was emotionally in several different places emotionally every time she did a scene. And you got to give a nod to the script on that, to the character as well, but she nailed it. While you're looking that name up, I'll say that I watched it with my brother, and he's never been a huge Jared Leto fan. And while I was watching it, I was thinking that I think that Jared Leto has one of the hardest parts in the movie because it's the most to play into a cliche. I would think, and again, I'm trying to do this without spoilers because we've seen the archetype. Well, we've seen a lot of the archetypes before, but we've seen this is an archetype we've seen before, and it has the potential to be played really two-dimensional, whatever. And I was all in. I was watching him going, man, I don't know if I could. I just don't know if I could do that. Like, as an actor, I don't know if I could do that part and sell the reality of it.
Robin Wright is great in this. You know, it's been great seeing her in more and more things recently. Dave Bautista even gives a decent performance when he's on screen. Like, it's just down the line, you can tell that the material. You know, a lot of times I'll talk about actors elevating material. In the Patreon pre-show, I talked about The Mountain Between Us and how Kate Winslet and Idris Elba, you know, elevate that material. It can go the other way, too. And I'm not saying, I mean, these are great performances, but I think the material, like you're saying, even elevates them further because they're given such a great workspace, you know, to deliver what they're doing. And so I think that's why down the line they're great. Her name, by the way, is, I think, Sylvia Hoax. Hoeks, and I just thought she was absolutely fabulous. I also see Ana de Armas here, who played Joy in the movie, which was Gosling's companion. She was great, so I wanted to mention her. And then Mackenzie Davis, who I love from *Halt and Catch Fire*, which is a great TV show, has a great part here too. So just down the line, bunch of great performances.
Well, and we still have. For those who like the first one, Edward James Olmos does. We do see him in this one. That's not a spoiler. That's pretty early in the movie.
Okay.
And he's also on IMDb. So.
Well, there you go.
You would know that. So he's not really spoiling. I'm not saying what he does. I'm just saying he is still there and he still does a solid job.
The other thing I wanted to talk about before we try to find some negatives unsuccessfully is. just the world building, and you know, the glimpse you see in the first Blade Runner of this world, and I just think it's so fully expanded here with what they're doing in this movie that I loved it. It was, and that's another reason that it never felt, you know, I never felt the length of the movie, is because I just loved being in this world. It was just incredible.
Yeah. I would 100% agree. I like how, this was in the first one too, like how busy and dense some of it is. And then this one, we get to see, like I said, other aspects of our planet, you know, at this point, and the not dense and not busy,
yeah,
but still has its own personality. And it still can be almost the polar opposite, but still fits into the exact same world perfectly.
Yeah, it's a really impressive feat. At times I had a feeling with the themes and such of Her, the Joaquin Phoenix movie, you know, mm-hmm. kind of touches on some of those elements of technology and, you know, how we interact with technology. Although I think it's probably safe to say Her owes some of where it went with its themes from the original Blade Runner. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of art influencing.
Yeah, I would
art.
Argue that any movie made after Blade Runner owes something about the future, owes something to Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Even if it's just like, oh crap, look how well the futurists, the guy, that's the first time I ever saw that title on a movie, a futurist, and it's people who, like, their job is to legitimately find what is a legitimate prospect for the world to come. So they don't just like, what would be cool in a future world? They're like, well, this type of stuff could be likely, and this type of things, mm-hmm. these type of things might happen. Meaning their version of the future was so, like, the study of it was so great. So anybody who made a movie about the future after that, whether they want to admit it or not, like, they have to pay a nod to it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's some of the stuff I love the most, you know, when something just feels authentic, you know, that it could be our future. Now, obviously, it's, you know, probably not going to be our future 32 years from now, when this sure, movie takes yeah. place. But that's because the original movie didn't go far enough in 2019.
Yeah, we're already not where the first one says we would be.
That's right. I don't see any buildings in Los Angeles with flames coming out of the top. That's all I'm saying. It's just not happening
yet.
Yeah, any negatives you can pull? Anything you thought, you know?
I had two negatives to the experience, but they are not directly related to the movie. I mean, they're indirectly related to the movie. And I only wrote them because I'm like, we're going to have to talk about cons as well. My first one is how worried I was about how they were going to treat Decker's character.
Yeah.
I had tension in me about what they were going to do. They never gave me anything in the movie that made me distrust them other than all the other movies that are made as sequels or reboots that makes me
right.
distrust, you know. But they ignored that. They were so true and honest. So I was very happy with that. And the other con, I don't think this is a spoiler either, because Harrison Ford's just, he's just in his mid-70s. The first time you see him, I just did not like seeing a man who has had multiple broken bones and broken backs and plane crashes
yeah.
in his mid-70s having to, you know, walk around and do stuff. Like, I hurt, and it fit with the character, but I hurt watching him the first time you see him.
Well, that could actually be a pro, though. I mean, you could actually, I mean, that's probably what you should be feeling with that character.
You're absolutely right. These, like I said, these are both personal things. They weren't with the movie. Like, that was just hard because, you know, Indy's my guy.
You just want, always, you're just like, Ford, you can relax now. You've done your work, man.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'm also like, please, I don't want to stop watching you and things, but also, yeah, I don't want, it's hard. It's like, it's a little, it's weird. He resembles my dad a little bit, so it was weird. My dad passed away last year. Watching him, some of these close-up scenes, especially his face, it was very hard, but also made the actual movie experience that much more interesting because I was just so in, like, I was so invested It was anyway, but that did nothing but add to that.
Yeah, we forget. I mean, he was doing Star Wars 40 years ago. 40 years ago.
Yeah.
You know? And he even got started in his career late. And he was in his 30s before he even started doing movies. So, yeah.
I think he was 40 when he did Temple of Doom. Like, he was already 40 at that point. Yeah. I think. He may have been, like, late 30s, but he was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, 40's young. I mean, Tom Brady's 40. I mean, you know, let's just be honest.
Sure. Also, we've just passed 40, so it's super young.
That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying is 40 is so super young. It's really
young.
But
I do know, like, my personally, like, what I deal with in my regular life, and I'm like, that's what he looks like and how he was doing whenever he was this age. That's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you speak for yourself. I go out and do parkour every night, so
I know you do, yeah. Yeah. You also got a big head of black hair, and mine's all getting gray.
Well, I've got gray. Don't you take away my gray. I love my gray.
You've got a gray.
I've seen
you.
The only negative I would say is if you're in the wrong headspace, I can see this movie being torturous. Like if you come into it and you start seeing melodrama in it, I can see it not clicking for you in the same way that the original Blade Runner doesn't click for some people. But that is not the experience I had. And apparently it's not the experience a lot of people are having. So I could be wrong about that. But anyhow, I really didn't have any specific negatives that I wanted to bring up.
I would say don't watch it late.
That's a good call.
Because it's not a fast-moving movie. It's well worth every second, but it's a deliberate pace. And if you're watching it at midnight and it's 3 hours, I mean, that's just science.
Yeah. The only other thing I would add before we move on is it's definitely rated R. The way they use the violence, the language, the nudity, it's meant for adults, not children. So that's definitely something that I know some people would want to know.
Sure, yeah. But still not as gratuitous. I'm trying to think, maybe, is it? I mean, that deserves R, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't call it a hard R, though.
I'm just not sure when in the next 30 years billboards are going to go to full frontal nudity. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I'm not saying you see full frontal nudity in the movie. I'm just saying the characters do, and not necessarily that you do.
True.
Anyhow, I wanted to get that out there before we headed on. Overall, though, I think it's a huge recommend, especially if you're a fan of the universe, fan of sci-fi, a fan of Denis Villeneuve. I think he knocks it out of the park.
Hey, before we move on, have you read the book? Was it Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Have no, I haven't.
I haven't either. And even after watching the first one, I never really had a huge desire to. But this is making me want to dig into that a little bit, actually, and just see, because I don't think it's, I mean, it's not the same story, it's just based on some of the same concepts, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the impression you had or not?
Yeah, that's the impression I get, is that it just kind of jumps off from those concepts and those ideas and then pulls a story around it.
Gotcha.
That's the idea I got,
which is compelling.
Yeah,
compelling stuff.
Yeah. Definite recommend for me, I'm sure from Josh as well. It's definitely, it's spectacular. I would say biggest screen, best sound system you can find. It's definitely a movie that rewards that kind of stuff.
I wrote a note. I want to say this. It is an intentional, handcrafted, artisan, big budget film.
That is correct. Yeah. All right, let's move on to the best ever challenge, Josh. We're going to do the best ever Ryan Gosling movies. I've already praised him effusively in this podcast, so let's talk about some of his best films. Now, these are more movies, how we do it, movies that Ryan Gosling is in, not necessarily movies you would consider a Ryan Gosling starring vehicle. Any movie he's been in would qualify. So we're going to go from number 3 to number 1 and then do some honorable mentions at the end. If you've got something higher than I have it, feel free to trump it, and we will talk about it when it's time on your list. Why don't you kick us off? What do you got at number 3?
Lars and the Real Girl.
I wondered if you'd talk about Lars and the Real Girl. I still haven't seen it, so tell me about it.
Okay. It is, so it's the first time I really paid attention to him. So number one, so that's why it's got a special soft spot in my heart.
Yeah.
The story is, it's a really charming, sweet story. It's quirky and interesting and funny, and it's got a lot of heart. It's got some, you know, some nice drama too. It in an era, and when it came out, it kind of was in an era of this indie barrage of the same types of movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think most people know it or have seen it or heard of it, but it did get lost a little in the mix, and I think that it stands above a lot of the others that kind of were in that same era. But I especially love it because it's the first time I really saw him.
Lars in the Real Girl.
The gist is he has a inflatable doll that he is treating like his real person, and everybody in the town is going along with it because they, that's what's best for him. That's his his only way out is to kind of work through. Like there's too much trauma if someone were to expose the truth, right? So it's just a movie about. It's a movie about a lot of stuff, but one of the, it's about community and it's about, it's just solid. It's just real solid.
I definitely need to check that out. My number three is Remember the Titans. We all think of that as a Ryan Gosling film. Remember the Titans, I had at number three. I mean, it's cheesy sports movie in some ways, but it's really effective. And a lot of that has to do with the performances, Denzel. Chief among them. So I really enjoy Remember the Titans, so I had that at number three.
Right now, I've never actually seen that one.
Wow.
So maybe I should watch that. You watch Lars the Real Girl, I'll watch that.
All right.
I usually don't jump on sports movies, and so that was... It's the same. I should have put that in my submarine movies and man versus nature movies and courtroom dramas.
And biopics. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right, yes.
What Josh is saying is he doesn't really like film.
Movies.
He's just not a good. He's not a movie guy. All right, what do you got at number two?
La La Land, which I'm sure you're going to trump me.
Yes, I am going to trump you. We'll talk about that here in a bit.
What's your number two?
I have at number two The Big Short. This movie has grown on me since it came out. It was a couple years ago, right? I recently revisited it and was really struck by how well the conceit of that movie works. It is a self-correcting Wikipedia article. I'm fascinated by the breaking of the fourth wall in that movie and how effective it is. And also the performances are great. And I think it's because of the performances that it can somehow exist as both a fourth wall movie and also a just great telling of a true story. It's quite a balance. I don't know that I've ever seen anything like it.
When that movie came out, when I saw it the first time, I thought this is one of the best movies that I still don't understand. And they dumb some stuff down for you, but it's so like, it's insane. The actual story of that. What I loved and hated about it actually were this exact same thing. I was so conflicted about the fact that there's no main character, but everybody's the main character.
And
Ryan Gosling, his character is the only character that you're really allowed to, like, he's your window in, and he's the least accessible character in the movie almost.
Right. I think people forget Christian Bale's in that movie. It's such a great performance. For me, it's Bale and Carell. Those are the main guys that I kind of see as the dual leads. In my own mind, like in my memory. But you're right. The movie is very much about a historical event that involved a lot of people, and so it becomes a little unfocused in its character development, but it's. Story development is so good that the character development, kind of just gets dragged along with it in some ways.
Yeah. So I when Altman did Nashville, like there was a big conversation about like who the main character was, right? And so his thing was always, well, Nashville is the main character of this movie. It's not right. about the other people aren't the, and in this, I think the incident and the thing, the situation is the main character. But my problem was I still never fully understood that, and that's the main character, and our only window in is all these other characters. That's the only reason. Like I love watching the movie, but I still, like, even now, it's still complicated for me. Like I could not explain what happened to somebody.
Okay, well,
I can follow it when it's in the movie, but I can't explain. I couldn't turn around and explain that to somebody else.
All right, well, let's.
And that's not the movie's fault. That's the concept's fault, I think.
Let's take the next hour or so, and I'll try to walk you through it, kind of help you understand yeah, a little bit.
If I couldn't follow the dumbing down in the movie, I doubt you can help me.
I mean,
out
I don't
here.
Have anybody in a bubble bath over here or anything, but I think I can take a shot at it. All right, what do you got?
Sure.
What do you got at your number one?
Nice guys.
Very nice. That was in my honorable mentions. Right. I didn't realize. For me, that's one I need to watch again. I've actually still only watched it the once. I think people are right. I think it's a much better movie than I gave it credit for, because when I remember it, I remember really good things about it. I didn't come away from it loving it like everybody else. So I think I need to watch that one again.
Sure. What's interesting about Ryan Gosling is I've never. Like, going through the list and thinking about all this, like, there's not, like, I've never watched movies because of him.
Right.
And so, it's like, Nice Guys was one of my top movies of last year, but in my whole life, it's not necessarily one, but, like, when it comes down to Ryan Gosling stuff, I'm like, no, I think that's my favorite thing he's done. And it's because he doesn't have a huge library, number one. He did a lot of TV when he was younger.
Yeah.
So that, but then also, like, he's smart and he's sharp in his movies and stuff, but he just doesn't do a ton that I've seen. Well, that's the truth.
And and you're right. He's also, not the, excuse the pun about a movie we'll talk about in a second, the driving force in a lot of the movies that he does, but he's such a presence. I think that's changing. I think you're going to see him because he's proven a little bit of versatility for sure in kind of the roles he's taken. I think you're going to see him taking more of those, center stage performances. I could be wrong about that, but it's definitely.
I think he's
enjoyable.
Great in everything. Like, I think he's great in everything I've seen him do. And he has a nice diversity too. Like, his confidence is always there, and his prowess is always there. But his characters they fluctuate pretty good. He's not playing a type.
Right. Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, he's totally different in The Big Short than he is in La La Land. And I guess we can just kind of transition into that. Although I suppose with Nice Guys, we probably should talk about Russell Crowe a little bit, because I was really impressed with Crowe's performance in that movie, because I don't know that I'd seen him do comedy in that way. And I wonder if Gosling's a part of that. I wonder if he brings that out in people.
Yeah, I wonder. And he clearly works well with other comedians. Well, he's done a couple with Carell, and that's the feeling I get from him, is that he's a very, like, just a very present actor, and meaning, like, he gives everything he can to the other performers, whether it's comedy or not, to help lift each other up. It's like one of the basic tools of acting. But when people become more and more of the stars, you see less of that, like, connection with people, I think. Sometimes, not always.
I also feel like there's a video going around right now. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but it's of a press interview that he and Harrison Ford are doing with some, morning show channel, whatever. And it just kind of goes off the rails, and it's hilarious. I just feel like he has a great sense of room energy and comedy and timing. And if you can get Harrison Ford giggling, I think, like, you are doing something that a lot of people can't do. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Harrison Ford has the grumpy old man, persona for a reason. He doesn't suffer fools, but man, he was giggling and laughing and, so I feel like that Gosling must have, something in him that does that. And I feel like Russell Crowe benefited from that in The Nice Guys for sure.
Sure. Yeah, I'll buy that. Yeah.
All right, let's talk about La La Land. You had it at number two.
La La Land.
I have it at number one. La La Land to me will be one of those defining movies of, you know, my cinematic worldview, my cinematic life. Mm. I didn't know that another musical could happen that would own me in the same way that my favorite musicals do, like Singing in the Rain or, you know, whatever it might be. And this movie comes out in, you know, mad props to everybody, but especially Damien Chazelle for putting it together. And Ryan and Emma are so transcendent in that movie. And what happened was, I think because it came out at the end of the year, you had a lot of critics who were seeing it at like Cannes and different things like that and raving about it. And I think I've never seen a movie with that much hype. When it finally came out, I think people were a little underwhelmed. And so I don't think it got the kind of the praise from the general movie going public that it might have if they hadn't heard about it and hadn't heard about how amazing it was. But I just remember when I saw it, I was blown away.
Well, I didn't watch it. Number one, I didn't watch it in the big screen, which I wish I had now.
Oh, yeah.
I watched it long after most people did, because it didn't, based on the trailers and, again, all the hype, I was not turned off, but I just wasn't turned on to watch it.
Yeah.
My wife, who hates musicals, when we sit down and start watching this and she realized it was a musical, I saw her heart crush.
Oh no.
And I watched that movie win her back.
Oh wow.
And by the halfway point, I don't remember what it wasn't even the halfway point. It was the scene after they are at the top of the street looking out, and you know, they do their first number together.
Yeah.
Yeah, whenever he starts walking back to the car that was never up there.
Uh-huh.
Then she goes, "All right, I'm in." And then she was all in. And I was too. Like, it's a beautiful movie. It is, what a lovely love song to classic film and modern film. It is, those two together are unbeatable. Right at this point in time in my life, I am happy to watch the two of them do anything together.
Yep.
Because I thought they were hysterical in Crazy Stupid Love, which we'll talk about in our honorable mentions
for sure.
But and this is as well. Yeah, I'm with you, man. I wish that I had seen it on the big screen. That's definitely a movie that left me wanting more.
For me, it just checked all the boxes. And I've heard people who disagree with almost every point, but I think the music is wonderful. I think the lyrics are really interesting and nuanced. Yeah. And I think the dancing, even though it's obvious they're not, you know, Fred and Ginger, what they pull off in those scenes is really impressive. And the key is they're pulling the emotion out of it, which I think they do very well.
They're protected. They're really, as the actors are protected with that. They didn't make them try things they couldn't do.
Right.
They didn't make them sing things they couldn't sing. They always let it be, first and foremost, like, the character was always first.
Yeah.
And that truth resounded through everything they did.
And then you add that to how beautifully consistent and perfect the themes in that movie are. And how perfect the ending is for those themes. About dreams and sacrifice and pursuit. It is one of those movies, again, like I said, it will define part of my cinematic experience of my life. I love it.
I buy that. I buy it.
All right, so now that I've convinced everybody that La La Land is the greatest movie ever made, we can continue and talk about the honorable mentions.
Although DJ Mill does not agree with you.
DJ M3.
DJ M3, sorry, not email, sorry. I'm looking from far away.
Yeah, I get it. I get that some people don't understand, you know, the movie or whatever, but yeah, for all those reasons, it is, and more, it is one that I definitely love. Let's talk about some honorable mentions.
Right on.
You mentioned Crazy Stupid Love. Did you want to talk any more about that? I had that in mind, too.
Yeah, that's a movie that I had a blast with. I did not love the ending of. It lost me in the ending, but the journey was a blast. And specifically, the two of them, Ryan and Emma together, what, like, those were, those scenes were a blast.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I don't love it, you know, whole hog, but it definitely, at parts, it is so vibrant and fun and interesting that I'm in. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I need to watch that again. It's been a while since I've seen Crazy Stupid Love.
I should too, actually. Yeah, it's definitely one that I had it was fun. It was a fun watch.
Yeah. A not so fun watch at times is one of the ones that I mentioned, Drive, which I think is
My other one too.
a lot of people know him for, and really is the movie when you look at, okay, you know, the movie that he is center stage and kind of stars him. It might be one to think about, but it's an impressive movie. It's definitely got an energy to it that is aggressive and doesn't stop and kind of holds on to you and shakes you around. So, you know, it's a good watch.
It is. There are scenes that I can rewatch. I don't know if I'm in for the whole movie. Maybe later in my life I'd be in to watch the whole thing again. But having taken in the whole movie, I can fill in the dots and just watch like some very specific scenes that I thought were transcendent compared to the rest of the movie. I would say transcendent. I don't use that lightly. Like, they were so good. Like, it's parts of it are so perfect.
Yeah,
I would say.
And of course, you've got, you know, Marlon himself playing a you know, an interesting role and a different kind of role. So yeah, Marlon, by the way, is the actor Albert Brooks, right? Everybody, Marlon from Finding Nemo. Okay. Perhaps I just should have said Albert Brooks. Possibly,
maybe. I was for a second, I was like, Marlon, what does he mean? Oh, Marlon. My first thought was like, Marlon Wayans was not in that movie. Yes.
No, I'm sorry. Everything is Pixar related to me. No,
you are. I forgot who I was talking to.
He is giving a performance there, I think, that rightly got a lot of attention. And I love that dude. I think he is.
Me too.
Hilarious. I only had one others. Did you have any other?
That was it. That was it for my, honorable mentions.
The only other one I wanted to mention was Place Beyond the Pines. And I think that's a worthwhile watch. It is one that I don't think a lot of people have seen. But I find it fascinating, interesting, dramatically compelling. So, I would give that one a recommend.
That's the other one with the same director, right? From Drive. I'm thinking of something different, aren't I?
You know what? Honestly, I don't remember who directed Place Beyond the Pines, but I can look it up real quick.
He did two with the, I should know the director's name.
Derek Clanfrance.
Clanfrance. All right.
He did something else
and
too?
He did two with him. He did Drive and he did something else with him.
Let's see. Movies include Place Beyond the Pines, Blue Valentine. That's the other one he did with Gosling.
Okay. That one, that was before. Yeah.
Yeah, that was 2010.
Which I didn't see that one.
Yeah. So, yeah, The Place Beyond the Pines is a good watch, I think. Definitely something that might be interesting to check out if you haven't seen it. If you don't know much about it, it's Gosling and Bradley Cooper kind of playing two different leads. In different stories and goes to some interesting places. So that'd be one at least I put in my honorable mentions. Before we move on to the end of the show, do want to remind you that this is a listener-supported podcast network, meaning Sif Pop and other podcasts like it are on a network called Studio DNA, and people support that network so that different podcasts can kind of be created and come to you. So if you would think about supporting, it starts at $3 a month, comes with some pretty fun perks, including your own podcast feed where you get all the bonus episodes. For instance, on our bonus episode for this show, for the Patreon pre-show, we actually reviewed The Mountain Between Us. So some thoughts on that in there. And if you are a patron, you get all that stuff right in your podcast player. Also want to make you aware that a new podcast is on the network. The Horrible Movie Podcast should now be showing up in your Patreon podcast feed. So you can check those guys out. Just search for Horrible Movie Podcast in your favorite podcast player. You should be able to check them out as well. We're having a great time bringing you this stuff. So if you want to support, we'd appreciate it. It's patreon.com/studioDNA.
Patrons get those perks.
Well, now you got it.
Now I got it. I wanted to say it sooner, but I didn't want to interrupt you. You were on a roll.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks. I appreciate that. That's very considerate of you. You know, you're a very considerate actor. I appreciate that about you.
Oh, thank you. I try to give. I try
very
to
unselfish.
Give.
You can tell you've got some work in the improv, you know, world. It works well. All right, let's move on to our SIFT quest for this week. This comes to us from Josh via email. And if you want to get a SIFT quest in and put us on a quest for answers, you can get your question to us via email or on Twitter. On Twitter, I'm Aaron Dicer, A-A-R-O-N-D-I-C-E-R. So feel free to tweet me there with any question you have or any debate that you want solved. Josh says this, my question is a bit complicated and long, but if you read the whole thing, I'm sure you'll find it as interesting as I do. Well, you can't guarantee that, Josh. I'm already bored. This is like the original Blade Runner. Boring and pretentious.
Hey.
Just kidding, Josh. So here it goes. For the last few years, I personally have felt that the Academy Award for Best Picture has gone to the wrong movie. Moonlight over La La Land, Spotlight over Mad Max, and 12 Years a Slave over a whole bunch are just a few examples. I'm not sure why in some cases. It just feels like the wrong movie wins, but it does. My proposed change to the Academy Award system, although it would never happen, is that the award for Best Picture go to the film with the most Academy Awards in total through the whole show. This means that truly the most well-crafted film in all aspects would win the award. There are some interesting complications, such as are all awards worth the same amount and what to do in case of a tie. I was wondering if you would agree or disagree with this and if there were any proposed changes that you had to the awards system. So let's start with his suggestion, Josh, and chat a little bit about that. I guess I'll say that I don't know that that's a great idea to do kind of a compilation award, because I don't know that you could. I think in many ways the best film isn't necessarily the sum of its parts. Does that make sense?
Yep. I think that it's ridiculous if a film were to win every award and then not win Best Picture.
Right.
I think that seems ridiculous. I'm a little out of the loop a little. I mean, I haven't watched the Academy Awards in a very, very long time.
Oh, interesting. Why not?
The politics of it, you know, that actually addresses one of his later parts of the question. But it seems so arbitrary. A couple of things. It seems arbitrary to vote on the best art. Like, it seems like to defeat the purpose a little bit in a venue that's supposed to be subjective, but also the political campaigns around getting your movie voted for create an uneven playing field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, so it's like, oh, that movie's tons better, but they didn't have the budget to buy everybody, I don't know, flowers or what, I don't know. You know what I mean? And that's what it is. So I get that it has a monetary value to have an award, like it translates to more work and more possibilities and that. But most of the time when I hear the awards, I generally don't agree or don't care if I do. Generally.
Well, no, I think it's good to have this conversation out of the gate, too. I'm an awards person. I love them. I think they're... Yeah. For me, what awards do is they're not meant to be some objective standard of this was the best, you know, thing. They're meant to cause conversation.
Agreed.
They're meant... I mean, think of what we do. We love having conversations about what our favorite movie of the year was, right? Well, that's really similar to what awards are doing. They're saying, hey, what was your favorite movie of the year? And let's come to some kind of consensus on that and award, you know, give an award. And what I see them really doing is honoring movies that may not have another way to have value in the commercial system. In other words, movies that aren't selling a lot of tickets, but are great, you know, stories or art or doing good things. I think without the award season, a lot of those movies don't get made because the people who write the checks don't have that prestige thing calling on them to make those kind of movies. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, that absolutely makes sense. And I even agree conceptually, and maybe it's my more the heart of it that I disagree with, because that all makes sense. I think for every movie like that, though, there's probably half a dozen that are even more under the radar than that, that are probably as good or better, you know, but they'll never even get that opportunity because they don't have whatever that extra oomph it is to get on the radar there. We're still dealing with movies that, and with some exceptions, we're still dealing with movies that have some sort of big exploitable element of a director or an actor or something, you know, generally, not always, but a lot of the time. But I don't disagree, and I like the idea of lifting that up. I think maybe my problem is more with the perception of it, that people do regard this as the end-all be-all of what's true and not. And we can go back and look at past winners, you know, forever and disagree. Like, that right. one over this movie that people yeah. are still talking about, that's nonsense, you know. Yes, and that goes back to it, just it's being subjective, you know.
Let's count the number of Oscars that Hitchcock won, you know. Those kind of
yeah, exactly.
Those kind of things that you know something isn't right. And I've actually, so let's move on from that, because I think we can probably agree that we're not on board with necessarily this idea. But I think there are some ways to correct the award system, and I've got two in mind. Let's start with this one, since I think it transitions nicely from what we just said about awards not holding up. I think we should do an award show during the year when stuff happens, and another one 10 years later. I feel like every year we should be doing this year's awards and a re-awards from 10 years ago, so that the Oscars would have maybe even two ceremonies or whatever. But I just think that would be fascinating. So, you know, for instance, this year we would, you know, the 2017 Oscars and also the 2007 re-Oscars or whatever you would want to call it. I think that, to me, and maybe even do another one for 50 years ago. I don't know. I'm just saying there's something fascinating about how time changes our perspective. And I think I would love that. I think that would be very interesting.
Also, can you imagine, though, if you won then and then comes back, like, oh, by the way, you're not as good as you thought you were. So now it feels like, oh, I'm getting my award taken away.
No, you're absolutely right. The person who won it 10 years ago should have to hand it over to the person who wins. And they're like, sorry, didn't hold up.
There should be a cage match that... Yeah, if there was more physical violence in the award system than if there was a battle for the award, then yeah, I think that would be more fun. What's your other idea?
did you have one before I get to my second?
I don't know what the idea is, but I address the campaigning, you know. I don't know, a cap on campaigning budgets.
I guess maybe the budgetary aspect you could.
Yeah, I just don't. I mean, but it's still like, if you're in Hollywood and you're in the system, you're hanging out and having lunch with people who vote. You know what I mean? And if you're out of the system and you're trying, you're like, I just want to get my movie seen. Like, you're not greasing palms and shaking hands and meeting people. You're not networking. Then you just don't have a chance.
Yeah.
In that regard, with some exceptions. I don't have an answer there. I just think that that's something it would need to be addressed on some level.
Yeah.
But
and I think the Golden Globes are notorious for being able to be bought. You know, that's kind of the hubbub in the industry, is that you can buy a Golden Globe because of the limited number of people that vote, for one, and how disconnected they are from the typical. It's so weird that the Golden Globes is a thing. Like, it's just that voting body is such a weird conglomerate, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association or whatever. So it's interesting that that's become kind of the second prestige award. I think there is maybe something you could do with the financing, you know, of budget, but you can't keep people from asking for, like, you can't keep people from going out and saying, hey, would you vote for my movie? But maybe you can keep them.
Sure. No, and it's a model that I think lots of things follow. A lot, like, there's lots of things that do that. And that's always that. I had a friend who just had a entered into a film festival in Memphis, and the awards were based on, you know, the panel of judges and audience response. And the person who won was literally the person who was able to get the most people to come watch the movie in Memphis.
Right.
And that, I mean, I get that they make it a piece of the puzzle, and I don't know what the remedy is, but it wasn't nobody's watching or listening from there, but it wasn't the best movie. I mean, it just
right.
wasn't. And I know that that's an opinion.
Sure.
Yeah,
but you can stack the odds, all those kind of things.
Maybe the bigger issue is like that, going back to grading something that's subjective in the first place, you know?
Yeah, but again, it's not, I mean, it's it should at its best be something that is still acknowledged to be a subjective process, but it's just, it's a conversational process in an interesting way to highlight what a group of people think is worth highlighting.
Sure.
So anyhow, the only other thing I thought of is something I think the awards are going to have to address here, probably pretty quickly, which is, I think gender is going to become an issue in the award system, if it isn't already. It becomes more and more strange that we're giving Best Actress and Best Actor awards instead of just a Best Performance award and a Best Supporting Performance award. Especially in a culture that is more and more speaking of gender fluidity, speaking of the spectrum of gender, those kind of things, you know, gender being self-identified, you know, so it just, it becomes one of those things where we get how weird and silly an idea it would be to have an African-American best performance and a Caucasian best performance. But for some reason, we've done the male-female thing for so long that we don't see our way clear on it.
They don't do that for directors or screenwriters or anything else. No. They don't say the best male director or best female director.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think the argument is, I think there are actually probably several arguments. The main one I've heard has to do with the pool of, you know, possible performances being too good to, you know, honor everything. I think that's a little bit of a cop-out. And if you're saying, well, you don't feel like female performances will get honored, well, then that's an issue we have to deal with in the same way we're dealing with the racial issue. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's something we should be forced to deal with, you know, and I think it could be actually a positive thing in that regard. So I think it's something that has to be done. My suggestion would be to do an overall best performance with the gender categories still for a little bit, and then just go to an overall performance and a supporting performance. Although what you could do is you could have just a best performance category that included male, female, and supporting and lead, so that there aren't any of those distinctions. Just best performance in a movie this year. And I think that could be interesting. What it will do, and this I think is a fairly decent argument, is it will tip the hand for those other categories. So for instance, if, you know, Meryl Streep gets nominated for best overall performance and no other female does, well, then you know Meryl's probably going to win the best actress award. You know what I'm saying? So there could be a killing of the suspense, but you kind of have that with, you know, best animated film. Like if an animated movie gets a best picture nomination, you kind of know they're going to win best animated film. So I don't know. I think you could do it. I think you could be smart about it and figure out a way to do it.
I think that would be a cool idea.
You could even, I actually have recommended this in the BFCA for the Critics' Choice Awards to a few people, all of which who have said it would never work and was a horrible idea. But I like the idea of doing a live award. And I think what you could do to not tip your hand is give the awards, and then let's say whoever won, you know, best actress, best actor, best supporting actress, and best supporting actor, then you do a live award at the end for best performance between those four or something like that. That could be interesting. But I think a lot of the kickback on that has to do with the actors themselves. They think would be offended by that. And I'm not sure I follow that, but again, I'm not an actor, so I don't know.
I don't know that I would.
Yeah.
But we've already established that I don't care.
I think it's kind of what you were saying with. I think it's kind of what you were saying with the. If we did like a 10 years later, and you were like, oh man, I guess I wasn't that good. I think it's that thing of you're kind of diminishing the award they already won. Now they go from being a winner to a loser, in some ways. So.
Well, I mean, they do. They do a lifetime achievement, right? So there could be a cultural longevity award or something. You know what I mean? Like this movie, despite not getting awards 10 years ago, has remained a piece of our culture.
Yeah.
You know?
So, there you go. That's what I would say. So there's your SifQuest for today. Thank you so much, Josh, for sending that along to us via email. The email, again, is feedback@sifpop.com. You can also send us on a quest through Twitter. Just tweet me at Aaron Dicer, AaronDicer. All right, before we finish up.
Patrons, get those perks. No, oh, wait, sorry.
No, Josh. I jumped in. Not right now. No, you're okay. You're okay, man.
Sorry.
Let's do our buried treasure. It can come from any area of pop culture. What's something you want people to know about?
Well, actually, last night I came across something that some people may know about, but I thought since we are talking about Blade Runner, this would be a very nice buried treasure. There are three short films that fill in the gap between the first Blade Runner and the new Blade Runner. They are generally expositional.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. They're generally expositional, but they are really fun. And if you haven't watched the movie, they could be a really nice appetizer to get you in the mood to watch the movie.
Mm-hmm.
One is called 2036 Nexus Dawn, and it takes place in 2036. And they address this in the new Blade Runner movie, what Nexus Dawn would mean. So I guess if you watch this, it's not a spoiler because it's talking about the new generation of the replicants. 2048, which is one called Nowhere. It's called 2048 Nowhere to Run, and it actually explores Dave Bautista's character a little more, precursor to this movie.
Okay.
And then the third one is called Blackout 2022, and it's an animated, and it's longer than the other. It's like the other ones are like 5 minutes, 5 or 6 minutes. This one's like 15 minutes, and it's an animated piece that basically explains how the blackout of 2022 happens. And if you watch the new movie, you will know that there's a blackout that they reference. So basically, expositional spoilers before you watch the movie.
I think that reminds me a lot of The Animatrix, mm-hmm. where, you know, that kind of stuff that informed, and other movies have done. I think Alien Covenant did that too, had some pre-stuff. What's nice about this for me is I didn't know those existed, and I would never guess those existed from watching the movie. So there weren't missing pieces as I'm watching this movie going, why don't I know that? Whereas with Alien Covenant, I feel like there were. Like, you know, you see James Franco, his character for like 5 seconds, and you're like, did you literally just hire James Franco for 5 seconds? Well, no.
He has exactly.
He has this whole preview thing that I'm supposed to watch to understand, you know, stuff. It's just, you know, I think there's a good way to do that and a bad way to do that, and I felt like Blade Runner did it well. So that's cool. I didn't even know those existed.
They don't. If you've watched the movie, you don't need to go back and watch them to understand what's happening. There's a couple of moments that helped me clear up some stuff in the movie, but it's a great appetizer going into the movie. It'll whet your appetite for some stuff that they're going to talk about in the movie.
I'm going to do a buried treasure. This is a first. This is a first on Sif Pop. I'm going to do a buried treasure I actually haven't taken part of myself. So I'm going to tell you about something, a book that I haven't even read, but I'm going to go ahead and tell you it's out there because I find the concept so interesting that I think other people will too. It's just coming out. It's from a guy named Bill James who did a lot of work in baseball stats. If you hear the phrase sabermetrics, it's all those like advanced statistics that they use in the professional sports leagues. He's kind of the brain behind that. Well, he has a new book out that is nothing about that. But it's called The Man from the Train, The Solving of a Century-Old Serial Killer Mystery. And if you are a real crime kind of person, basically what they did was they took this group of serial killer murders from the early 1900s. These were known that they all kind of had, you know, the same murder weapon, the same MO, all that kind of stuff. And through research, has tied this one man to an entire another series of serial killer murders. This is somebody who was never caught, and also found the first one and identified who this person was all through research and going through old cases and that kind of stuff. Sounds fascinating to me. It's kind of like Unsolved Mysteries to the, you know, the nth degree. And so I'm interested to check it out, but I wanted to let people know it existed in case that's the kind of thing that sounded interesting to them as well.
Say the title one more time, The Man from the Train.
It's called The Man from the Train, and then the subtitle is The Solving of a Century-Old Serial Killer Mystery. And it's by Bill James. So it's definitely something I want to check out. And what's interesting is I'm not necessarily a true crimes kind of guy. Like, it's not something that has ever appealed to me, but there is something about solving a mystery, the Sherlock Holmes nature of how they did this, that is definitely fascinating to me. So maybe once I check it out, I can let you know if it's as good as I hoped it would be. But I wanted, since it's coming out now, to kind of throw that out there for Buried Treasure.
Sweet.
Well, there you go, Josh. We did it. We did a podcast.
Hooray! Patrons, get those perks.
Pods have been casted. We are casting the pods. Thanks so much for joining us today for Sif Pop. It is part of the Studio DNA Podcast Network. You can find out more about other live and later shows on the network by following the feed. It's at Mixlr.com/Studio DNA. That's Mixlr.com/Studio DNA. Huge thanks again to today's guru, Josh from the Nether Region. Thank you, Josh.
Woo-hoo, that's my name. Don't wear it out.
I am kind of wearing it out, but I'm glad to, because I want people to know all about you. Where do you want to send people?
At Nether Region on Twitter is great.
That's it.
That's a at Josh. Oh, you can also follow my my personal stuff, which I don't talk about much nerd stuff on there. But that's at Josh Josh W. Childs Twitter.
Give a follow, and I'm sure that way you'll know when like the Nether Region has new videos coming out. If anything's happening at the YouTube channel. You guys do some great stuff, so it's definitely worth checking out for sure. If somebody's in Nashville, can they check you out live? Like, I think, aren't you doing improv stuff as well?
I am. I actually have a show next Saturday at Third Coast Comedy. The show is called Court Improv. We basically put love on trial. We take a couple from the audience, and we do a complete improv show where we showcase their life story of how they met and fell in love, and then we put that story on trial to see if love should in fact be punished or not. So we do that generally every month. We are not doing it next month, but we have one next Saturday at 9 p.m. Third Coast Comedy, 9 p.m. Central Time, and then we'll be back again in December after that. But in that month off in November, I will be doing another show at the Nashville Jazz Workshop with my other improv comedy group, the Spontaneous Comedy Group, a comedy company, which is the oldest improv company in Nashville, or the longest running. That's what we say now that we're old, the longest running improv company in Nashville. And you can follow Court Improv at Court Improv on Twitter, or Spawn Comedy for Spontaneous Comedy Company.
That's awesome, man. That sounds really cool.
Mouthful.
Yeah, no, that's great. If you're in the Nashville area, I definitely recommend you check that out. Much love and gratitude to our Patreon supporters as well for giving to this podcast network monthly to make this show and others on the network possible. Support starts at $3 a month, comes with some pretty fun perks. You can find out more at patreon.com/studioDNA. There's lots of ways to connect with the podcast on SoundCloud, Twitter, iTunes, or you can email us feedback@sifpop.com. And finally, if you're having a good time, your movie loving friends will probably like the show too, so make sure you let them know about it, and that listening is much easier than figuring out who exactly is and isn't a replicant. Spoiler chat for this week's movie should be next up in your podcast feed, and we will see you back next week for more talk about whatever movies we decide to talk about next week.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.